Right, good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. Are there questions? No? If you didn't yet submit your homework on Friday, please make sure that you do today. So, what we did last time is we looked at a constructive variant of Koenig's theorem, which gave a way to find an augmenting path in a bipartite graph, and we also looked at the somewhat related problem of finding a stable matching. And we will have examples of this in the homework. So what I will now do is go on to the next topic. This is something which sits a little bit in between. It's a theorem which is reasonably prominent as a theorem in graph theory. As a result itself, it will not come that surprising. It's very simple. It really, if you see the previous theorem, Koenig's theorem, and you take the one which comes afterwards, it looks a little bit like a mixture of both. And I'm going to prove it mainly because the then following theorem, Max Flohmann-Katt, which is an important theorem, builds up very strongly on this theorem. Historically, actually, that is the theorem Koenig wanted to prove. Well, what he wanted to do is this. Yeah, so let me start writing this title of the section. So this is paragraph 3, and this is Menger's theorem. Menger had published this theorem in about 1920. Roughly 1920. And it turns out there was a gap in the proof. There was one case where the proof didn't work, and that was the case of bipartite graphs. And Koenig proved his theorem with a goal to fix this gap, to basically resolve this one case. So, not just abstractly, but really in terms of the idea, Koenig's theorem was a step towards the proof of this. However, it turns out to prove this using Koenig's theorem is longer than another proof which I'm going to give you. This other proof will probably remind you of the proof of Dilworth's theorem because it uses in some way the same idea. But it's about half the length than the alternative proof, which really would go nice cyclically from Koenig's theorem. So, we are talking again about graphs, and I will need a few definitions. Let's suppose U and W are non-adjacent vertices in a graph gamma. No idea why they called U and W and why I don't have V, whether this is the secret fear of the German to pronounce. Oh, and then they even wrote the with a V layer. Well, anyhow. So, I have two vertices which are non-adjacent. What is a UW vertex path? Vertex path in gamma is a path from U to W.
The reason you choose U and W is so that they are not adjacent in the alphabet.
Oh, that's a good reason. Thank you. Yes, that is a very good reason. Okay. A collection of UW vertex paths is called independent. is independent if they don't share any vertices apart from U and W. And W, and we are calling a set of vertices, a set S of vertices is U, W, separating if every U, W path must go via a vertex in S. Contains some vertex, some vertex in this set. And what we observe is that, let me state the theorem first. So the theorem for 8, and this is Menger's theorem. So let's suppose let U and W be non-adjacent. Then the maximum number of independent paths, independent UW equals the minimum size of an UW separating set. Okay. And in some way, if you look at the Hasse diagram as some kind of a lattice as some kind of graph, this looks very much like the setup is very similar to Dilworth's theorem. There we didn't have paths, we had chains, and we had not a separating set, but we had an anti-chain. But the idea, of course, of an anti-chain is these are things which somehow lie on a similar level. They are not comparable. That gave us that result. It's not surprising that the proof of this theorem also works somewhat similar. So let's start with a proof. Little m is the minimum cardinality of a separating set. The minimal cardinality of separating set, and big M is the maximum number of independent paths. And what I claim is that little m is at least as large as big M. Why that? Because if I have a set of independent paths and there is a separating set, this separating set must have one vertex on each of these paths, right? Because if there was one path where it wouldn't have a vertex on, the set wouldn't be separating. So it needs to have a vertex on at least each of one on each of the paths. So its size needs to be at least as large as the number of the paths. So I only need to show the other inclusion. And what I will now assume is that I want to do a proof by contradiction. So assume that gamma is a with some vertices and edges is a counterexample. With a minimum number of edges minimum number of edges. So this is this variant of proof by induction. Instead of saying we do an induction on the number of edges, one could instead say we look at a minimal counterexample with a minimal number of edges. And sometimes just this version of the induction proof is easier to do. Or, I mean, not conceptually easier, it's just easier to write down. Well, and what I want to have that... I need to show that M is greater or equal, big M is greater or equal than little m. So what I assume the being a counterexample, so I have two non-adjacent vertices U and W. Non-adjacent. And what I assume that there are fewer than little m independent vertex paths. So that there are, that I cannot reach m independent vertex paths. Okay, right. So now I want to use this induction property. And what I claim is that I have a separating minimal size separating set. So let big S be UW separating of minimal size. And what I claim is, and that's my first result, is that this set S contains a vertex that is adjacent to neither U nor W. Okay. So, why is this the case? Why can I assume, or why does there have to be a vertex like this? Well, consider an edge which is not incident to U or W. If little E is an edge not incident U and W, I could remove that edge and get a graph with a smaller number of edges. So, remove this edge E and get a smaller graph delta, which has the same vertices, but it has the edges minus this one particular edge E, this is a graph with a smaller number of edges. Okay. Right. So. Now I want to look at the UW independent paths in delta. And what I claim in delta, there are at most m minus 1 independent UW paths. Why is this the case? Well, in gamma I assumed that there are fewer than m independent paths, right? And I've taken an edge away that cannot create new paths. So in gamma there are at most little m minus 1 paths. So in delta there also are at most m minus 1 paths. But that tells me that the minimum size of an independent set in delta cannot be more than m minus 1. Of a separating set. So this means there is a UW separating set in delta of size, and this set gets a name, let's call it T, in delta of size m minus 1. And that's because of the theorem, right? We have in delta the number of independent paths is m minus 1 or less, so the minimal size of a separating set is m minus 1 or less. And if it is less, I can add vertices and have it as an independent set. Okay. So, we have an independent set of size little m minus 1 in delta. But if we now take this independent set, T together with one vertex, and now I can use the letter V, and what is V? Where V is a vertex adjacent to the edge E. To the edge E, well, what I claim is this set T is UW separating in gamma. In my original graph gamma. Why is this? This set is UW separating in delta. So in any path in delta which connects U and W must go through one of the vertices in T. Suppose I have a path in gamma which connects U and W. Well, either it does not use the edge E, then it is a path which is already a path in delta, and therefore it must have the vertex E, or it uses the edge E. But if it uses the edge E, it must go past the vertex V. So if I also forbid the vertex V, this set is UW separating. Okay. So, if S does not have a vertex which is adjacent to U or W, replace S by this set. This has the same cardinality, is UW separating, and has this vertex V which is not adjacent to U or V, because I chose an edge which is not incident to U or V. Okay. So we have this situation that S contains a vertex which is not adjacent there. Okay. Now the next part of the claim is there is no connecting path of length 2. There is no connecting path USW where we have that S would have to be an S because it's a path, and the only way it can be separating this path would be by being the middle vertex. So there is no path of length 2. Why is this the case? Well, if I had this, otherwise remove, so I get a graph delta which has its vertices, the original vertices, but I remove S, I remove some of the edges, I remove all the edges which involve S, and because S is on a path, S has edges, is incident to edges. So this will be a graph with a smaller number of edges, and so this is a graph with fewer edges. It has M minus 1 separating, has M minus 1 separating vertices, and has strictly less than M minus 1 independent paths. Why does it have stricter then? Because if there is a path of length 2, that cannot interfere with any other path. Right? Independent paths are not allowed to share vertices. If it is of length 2, well, then I could take that path, and regardless what other choice of paths I have, unless one of them would go really stupidly around or so. But since S is connected to U and W, I could any path which connects, which goes via S, I can assume without loss of generality, would be this particular path. And then I can always, if I have an independent set of paths, either this set of paths involves S, then it would involve this particular path without loss of generality, or it wouldn't involve it, and then I could add that path to the set and make it a larger independent set. So this is saying any set of independent paths in this case would involve, or I could assume involve, these paths. So by removing this, I'm removing one from a maximal set of independent paths. So then I would have again a counterexample of size smaller, and that cannot happen. Right. So what have I seen with this loss of generality arguments? I have the vertex U here, I have the vertex W here, and I know there is my separating set S here, and at least one of these vertices is adjacent neither to W nor to U. So there must be something like this. Okay. Right, and now comes the part of the argument which is very similar to the proof of Dilworth theorem. So let P U be the set of vertex paths between U and exactly one vertex in S. And PW defined in the same way but from W. So I'm looking at all of these paths which exist, not they're obvious, well, there is no reason that they would have to be independent, but I'm looking at all of them. Okay. Right. What I claim is that any path in PU and any path in PW, then any path in PU and any in PW share at most one vertex. Why is this the case? Well, take a path from U to some vertex in S. Take a path, well, and now I take another path from W to some vertex in S. If these two paths would share some vertex here, which is not in S, I could go to that vertex, not go to the set S, and go from here along that path, and could circumvent the separating set S. So that would contradict the separating property. Otherwise, S is not separating. So I know that they share at most one vertex in S. Well, and why don't they share two vertices in S? Because I want paths which go to exactly one, each of these paths to involve exactly one vertex on S. So they can't share two. Right. So okay, now comes the third claim, and that will finally give us the contradiction, and it will contradict this property here. So and of course what I want to do is I want to somehow connect these paths at S and thereby make paths connecting. So, claim all vertices in S are adjacent to U or all are adjacent to W. And when I've shown this, these two properties contradict each other. That can't both hold. Right? Because I said I have a vertex contained, not there. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I build a new graph. Consisting of the paths PU, the paths from U to S, all of them, the vertex W, and edges SW for all elements S in the separating set. So what I'm going to do here is I simply take everything down here down to S, and now I'm connecting each vertex of S with W. Okay? Well, unless if we have the case that W is not adjacent to all vertices in S, this is a smaller graph. This has fewer edges, right? Because I need to have at least edges in the original graph, I need to have at least one edge from every vertex in S. Otherwise, I wouldn't need it in the separating set. On for paths towards W, but I've shortened the paths, and there is at least one path where I must have removed a vertex in the middle and thereby removed an edge. So, if W is not adjacent to all vertices in S, then this is a smaller graph. Okay, so in this case we would have a smaller graph. So by the assumption, I have this independent set S. In my new graph, S is still an independent set, right? So, what I know is that I have little m independent paths. This is a smaller graph. So by assumption, by minimality, in this new graph, there are m independent paths from U to W. Why is this the case? Well, in this new graph, S still must be a separating set of minimal size. Because if there was a separating set of smaller size, that would still be separating in the original graph, right? Because everything has, every path would go through one of the vertices of S. If I could make it smaller up here, I could separate U from everything in S and thereby also from W. So, the graph is smaller. Minimality argument says then the theorem holds there. So I can find m independent paths in this smaller graph. So, what we get is these paths, of course, each of these paths must involve one of these yellow edges. So, if I forget about the yellow edges, this gives me a set, let's call it RU of, okay, and now I have cardinality of S independent, which was M, independent paths from U to the elements of S. So I started with all paths and they might share something, but by making this smaller graph I now can cope this nicely. I have now m different paths from u to these vertices here, which do not share any other vertices. Okay, I do the same thing the other way around. So, ditto, a set Rw of m independent paths from w to s, to the elements of s, and I combine these. Right? So I have the paths from u to s, m of them. I have paths from w to s, m of them, and I just combine them at the connecting vertices s, and I get independent paths. These paths, nothing here may share anything here, because that was this argument I had made before. So combine to little m independent UW paths. And I'm done. So the crucial part in the proof was really this step. If it's minimal, I can't have minimal counterexample. There must be something which is not adjacent u, not adjacent w. Yeah, and that proves this theorem. Let me mention, without proof, something which is a dual version of this theorem. Because sometimes that is used. This is still Menger's theorem, but it's an edge version. What does this say? The maximum number of edge disjoint paths, maximum number of edge, before we had vertex disjoint paths, so now we have edge disjoint paths from U to W, equals the minimum number, of edges whose removal would separate U and W, or would disconnect . And I'm writing it this way so I don't need to define corresponding terms of edge-independent paths and maximum edge-separating sets. Well, one reason why I mentioned this version of the theorem is because that's actually the version we will be using. The other reason is the proof of this, where I will not go through, but the proof really isn't hard. Because what we will do is, the way you can prove this, so for the proof, there we define something which is called the line graph. So for a graph, gamma, which consists of vertices and edges, the vertices of gamma and the edges of gamma, we define the line graph. The line graph L of gamma. And this line graph is a graph with vertices and edges. What are the vertices of the line graph? The vertices of the line graph are the edges of the original graph. so. The edges of gamma are the vertices of the line graph. And when do I connect them? So what is my edge set? Let's call it just E here, where, well, so when are, what are the edges in the line graph? So I need to take two vertices, which are edges in the original graph. So I have an edge E1, and then I have an edge E2. This is an edge in the line graph, if and only if these two edges share a common vertex. So if E1 intersection E2 is not the empty set. So what does this mean? And I think this is easiest seen in an example. Let's suppose I have that is my graph gamma, and I have edges, and the edges have names, little a, little b, little c, little d, little e, little f. So that's my graph gamma. Then what is the line graph of gamma? Well, for every edge, I need to make a vertex. So I have a vertex A, I have a vertex B, and I'm just drawing them in an arrangement which makes the drawing nicer afterwards. A, B, C, D, E, and F. Right, so now how do I connect? Are A and F connected? Well, the question is, does the edge A and the edge F share a vertex? They do. So A and F are connected. Similarly, A and C is connected. And A and B is connected. C and F are also connected. B is connected to A, to C, and to D. C is connected to A, F, B, and D, and E is connected to F and D, and D is connected to B, C, E, and F similarly is connected to A, C, E. So that's the line graph. Well, and if you take the line graph, an edge separating set of edges in the original graph now becomes a separating set of vertices in the line graph. And edge disjoint paths in the line graph come exactly, sorry, edge disjoint path in the original graph give me exactly the vertex disjoint paths in the line graph. And so by just applying Menger's theorem to the line graph, I get this version of Menger's theorem for edges. Okay. There are also versions of Menger's theorem which are for directed graphs. So there we want paths which follow the directions that we have. We have to distinguish whether we want to go from U to W or from W to U, and so on. The theorems are the obvious statements, again, that cardinalities are the same. I'm not going to prove this here, because the proofs are just technically harder, but don't give any further insight, nor will they help us proving things. So, yeah, that's this section on Menger's theorem, which is a reasonably prominent theorem in graph theory, though we will mainly use it as a tool towards the next step. Well, but before next step, let me briefly ask whether there are questions. No? So, Yeah, while this theorem in itself might look a little bit, it's not that much more what we had or what on earth do we need it for. We will get to something else which has obvious applications. And that's section, let's say section 3 was the previous one, and this is probably section 4, yes. And that's the Max Flohmann-Kapf theorem. Or another title, which probably is better, would be flow in networks. So, well, a network is just a graph, and we want to allow a directed graph where we have vertices, edges, and that models the ability to transport certain things. So, for example, you could take the road network in Fort Collins, any point, any crossing, any point where roads get together, you have a vertex, and you connect the vertices if there is a road between these two. And if the road goes in both directions, you connect in the directed graph in both directions. If it's a one-way road, you just connect in the direction of the one-way road. Well, there are roads of different capacity. You have some roads, College Avenue, which are relatively wide. You have other roads, which are, say, the oval, which are narrower, which don't have that much capacity. So, what we have is we have weighted edges, which describe the capacity. So, definition, a network is a digraph. Digraph just means directed graph with vertices and edges and with a weight function W, which goes from the set of edges to the non-negative, well, real numbers, though in our example I want to say non-negative rational numbers. And we have a source vertex S, and we have a target vertex T. And what we ask is, in this network, how much can we transport from S to T? In Fort Collins, if you have cars which are at the crossing of Harmony and College, and you want to drive them all to this parking lot, how many cars per time unit can you transport there? Okay, and that has obvious practical applications. And it has the question, how many can you transport in particular? Can you justify that something is an optimum? And that's where we're going to use this idea of the connectivity, which we developed before, but not today. Thank you very much, and I'll see you on Wednesday.